John and Sarah and other collaborator of John. You're the founder of, right?
That's right.
Of the Quantum Ethics Project. And John and Sarah are gonna give on March 27, right? They're gonna be the, gonna give a little talk, a little discussion. They're gonna facilitate a little discussion on quantum ethics, which is something very important to do when we start to try to use quantum mechanics to do stuff that we couldn't do before and see what are the implications of those. So John is gonna say a little bit about that. And that's gonna be a joint lecture, actually, with the course. I forget the name of, do you remember the name of the course? It was Machine Learning in Many-Body Physics? That's right. So both, everybody in those classes are gonna come here and we're gonna discuss about quantum ethics a little bit. So John, if you wanna say like a couple minutes.
Eduardo gave a very great overview. Hello, everybody. My name is John. I've met a few of you in the past, but most of you are new to me, so it's a pleasure. I'm a PhD student at the Institute of Quantum Computing. I've been in Waterloo for the past 4 years, versus a master's student now here. I'm originally from the United States, and my research specialty is quantum machine learning and near-term algorithms. I decided to found the Quantum Ethics Project because, as a student, I wanted to understand how my research would potentially impact people. If we get all of the things we hope we get, and we get near-term advantage of many of these algorithms that we develop, I wanted to understand who might most benefit from that work and who may be harmed by that work. Large-scale computing, artificial intelligence, there's lots of examples of communities that are left behind in technological revolutions. A small subset of wealthy individuals are likely to benefit the most. And trying to highlight the sorts of ethical concerns of the social impact of research in quantum, for me, is an important issue. Because for all of us here in this room, we are one day going to be the experts in the room. And one day we may have the ability to, if we are aware of these social impacts, shape our work for the greatest possible social benefit. I truly believe that quantum has the potential to change the world. But it can only do that if we are proactive. And if we lead with our values of equity and justice and these other crucial things in our work as well as in our daily lives. In my view, that's the only way we have quantum be a force for good. So on March 27th, my co-founder Sarah and I will be coming in. We're going to have a brief lecture at the beginning just to try and answer basic questions like, what does quantum ethics mean? What are some of the key issues? And once that context has been established, we will break the room up into different groups with different ethical dilemmas being quantum technology and give you all the chance to discuss how you would react in a situation where you may have the ability to tip the scales one way or another. The goal is to foster a group discussion. This isn't the sort of topic with a correct answer. This is the sort of topic that emerges as the result of all of our collective values. And fostering those discussions in the classroom and abroad is what the Quantum Ethics Project's goal is. So I'll stop there, let you all get back to your lecture. Thank you for the time, and I look forward to seeing you all on the 27th. I'm gonna stick around, so if any of you wanna ask questions or chat with me, I will be available after class. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sean, that was great. All right, so we are all going to be looking forward to it. All right, so going back to where we stopped, remember that we had a little discussion about, first of all, we talked about entanglement from the point of view of information theory. And entanglement, I remind you, I mean, we say it every day, right? Entanglement is can be defined as the amount of ignorance that you acquire about a subsystem A when you erase information about subsystem B. And that doesn't have a direct classical analog in information theory. Remember, that's the way we think of it from the point of view of quantum information, or information theory. Now, we also discussed that determining whether a state is entangled, if I give you an arbitrary bipartite state, rho AB, determining it is a very difficult problem. In fact, it's a problem that is not only difficult to solve, but also difficult to check a solution if you're given a solution. Now, because of that, we started to discuss, okay, it may be helpful to have a series of functions, right, or at least one function. If there was one, I mean, we wish there was one, but if there was one function that's able, remember, to map density operators, bipartite density operators, to the real numbers, So that is establishing a classification of states according to how entangled they are. That would be great. And that's what we call entanglement measures. Let's remind ourselves, entanglement measures. What were the desirable characteristics of entanglement measures? Who can remind me? We said four things, or three, depending on how you formulate them. What was number one, or one of them?
Zero or pure states.
Yeah, for what, sorry?
Pure states.
Not pure.
Sorry, unentangled, really.
That's right. Must be zero only, we said, right? For separable states. That way we write two of them in the same sentence. So it has to be zero for separable states, obviously. If you aspire to indicate how much entanglement might be a function, remember, this is going to be a function from the space of bipartite density operators to the reals, right? So if such a function is good, better be zero for separable states, and better be non-zero for all entangled states, right? Which is summarized in this sentence. What else?
Maximum times.
That's right. Must be maximum or what we call maximally entangled states. Entangled states. And recall what those are. Maximally entangled states are pure states for which when I raise the information about one of them, one of the subsystems, I end up with the maximally mixed state, the most ignorant state, on the other subsystem. That's how I define maximally entangled states. Make sense? And finally, perhaps the most important, yes?
Must not increase under LOCC.
That's right. Must not increase under LOCC. Because you cannot create, while it is true that you can create classical, as we saw, classical correlations via LOCC, by, you know, doing operations only on one subsystem and coordinating those operations by talking to a friend that can access the other subsystem and can do any kind of operations on the other subsystems that are physical, we know that we cannot create entanglement like that. We can create correlations, but not entanglement. You cannot map a separable state into a non-separable state through LOCC. Make sense, everybody? So these are the 3/4, depending on how you count them, characteristics that we will desire entanglement measures to have. Those are a must characteristics. Of course, ideally, we would also like for them to be easily computable, or at least easier than having to go through something that is so hard as an NP-hard problem. That is a bit of wasteful thinking, because if the problem is NP-hard, you know, if so happens that just computing a function, and if that function is positive, you can decide, that doesn't sound very NP-hard to me. At the very least, it could be hard, but it cannot be NP-hard, because that's very easy to check a solution if given, right? So, of course, there's going to be caveats, okay, as we will see. Any questions? This is a summary of the last things we discussed. So today I'm hoping to go through entanglement measures and, with a bit of luck, show one protocol of quantum information that uses entanglement as a resource, in particular with the most famous one, which is quantum teleportation. Make sense? So let's get to it. So the first entanglement measure that I'm not going to define, because we've already seen it, is the entanglement entropy, or candidates, rather. Remember that we already had that. This is actually kind of the core function that we used to define the notion of entanglement. Remember what entanglement entropy was? Is the von Neumann entropy of the partial state once you trace out one of the subsystems. The entanglement entropy is a von Neumann entropy, and therefore is a Shannon entropy associated with the probability distribution over pure states that is represented by that particular density matrix, right? So it is really nice, because the entanglement entropy, if it works, is truly the core of the notion that we have for entanglement, is how much ignorance I have on B after removing information about A. So the entanglement entropy could be a good candidate in terms of it's very easy to interpret physically what it means. So I have here four questions that I'm going to ask about entanglement measures. And we're going to see how they all fare. Okay? First one, time and entropy. Is it limited to small dimension? What does that mean? Well, can it work for bipartite states of any dimension? Or is it limited to qubits or, you know, 3 times 2 dimensions or something like that, right? Well, you know the answer to that. Is it limited to small dimension? No. So I'm going to write different levels. I'm going to have 2 levels of yes and 2 levels of no. This is level one. If it's a stronger no, I'm going to have an exclamation point, and we'll see what that means. And I'm going to have faces telling us if that's good or bad, OK? Because some no's are good and some yes are good. OK, some are better than others. That's what I mean. Is it easy to compute? Well, this is something that we would desire from an entanglement measure. So what do you think? Is the entanglement entropy easy to compute?
Yeah.
It is. Why do you say no?
The size of the density matrix is exponential in the number of qubits.
But the problem of diagonalizing a density matrix goes polynomial in the dimension of the matrix.
Right.
And once you have the eigenvalues, it's a sum.
Yeah, but
so
300 qubits is more entries than there are.
It scales polynomially. That's what I mean. Computed, if I give you a given density matrix, bipartite, your ability to compute the entanglement entropy is polynomial on the size. It's a diagonalization problem. I don't care how big it is.
But the number of entries would be exponential.
Okay. But that's true for all of them, right? So, but this is diagonalization. We don't care about everything the density matrix has to offer. We only care about eigenvalues. Okay, that makes it easy. It is easy. Computing entanglement entropy is easy. Yeah, typical, I mean, the go-to rule is, have you ever computed an entanglement entropy? Then it's easy. All right, it's an orientative. Sometimes you can compute the difficult ones for particular cases, but you've probably computed for more than one case. All right, it is easy to compute. This one is actually great. Maybe we can add, we can ask it afterwards. Okay, so here's another question, right? Does it work for non-pure states? I heard something, but I couldn't understand.
I said a no.
It is a no, very good. No, that's the main issue with it, right? Well, maybe I don't need the exclamation point. No, of course not, because we know that if we start with some ignorance already, even if the state is separable, but initially has some ignorance, we're gonna find that the entanglement entropy, or the so-called entanglement entropy, would be non-zero, and that is violating one of the things that we want from entanglement measures, right? So no, it doesn't work for pure states. Therefore, is it an entanglement measure?
No.
No, not in general. It is an entanglement measure, I'm going to write here yes, for pure states. But in general, of course, it's not an entanglement measure. Make sense? So now we know it's not a sacred entanglement measure. There's no such thing as a sacred entanglement measure. OK, so the nice thing, does it have, let me add another, does it have a nice physical interpretation? This is very subjective. But I think that in this case, for the entanglement entropy, the answer is yes, because it's kind of really, we really understand. When it's applicable, we really understand what it is. Is the amount of ignorance that I gain by tracing the other subsystems. So in that sense, I'm going to write a yes here, and we can discuss if we all agree, because that is very subjective. Huh? Some people may tell you, no, of course this one has a great physical interpretation. All right. So the first thing that we're going to see, right, is so the first measure. Any questions about the entanglement entropy, by the way? I know that we've revisited a lot, but all right, so the next question, next entanglement measure that I'm going to introduce is called negativity. Sorry, I lost the, can't believe it, I lost it. Sorry about this. Can do it without. The next measure is called negativity. I'm going to introduce. Sometimes you'll hear people call it entanglement negativity, but that's not really the name it was given to it. It's negativity. Okay. I guess it makes sense because there are negativities of many things. But in particular, the entanglement measure called negativity is based on the intuition that Peres criterion gave us. Right? Peres criterion gave us a sufficient condition for being entangled, which is if the partial transpose of rho AB is not a positive operator anymore, has negative eigenvalues, we know that the state must be entangled. And the reason we know that is because, well, remember, any product state, if you take the partial state of any product state, is going to be the, for example, partial transpose, if you take the partial transpose of the density matrix rho AB, and it's a separable state, that is a convex combination of products, it's easy to see that that's going to be, the partial transpose is going to be also a positive operator, because it's just tensor rho A, tensor rho B transpose, and the transpose of rho B is also a density operator. So if that fails, means that I cannot write, for sure, I cannot write a state as a separable state. So sadly, it's not an if and only if. It's only an if in this direction. And that means that it's not going to work always. But when remember that we discussed that, of course, it does work 100% if and only for 2x2 and 2x3 systems. Plus, in the systems that is not necessarily insufficient, we talked about the fact that this is distinguishing the notion that we call distillable entanglement. And if you remember, distillable entanglement was defined as the amount of maximally entangled pairs of dimension d, and typically it's just qubits, the amount of maximally entangled qubits that you can extract for n copies of the system rho AB. If you want to define it for one, you can average, you can divide by n. Okay, makes sense? So distillable entanglement is through LOCC. Distillable entanglement is helpful because if you want to use maximally entangled pairs, for example, as a resource for something, I mean, we will see quantum teleportation, for example, which uses that as a resource, then the fact that entanglement must be distillable for that is helpful. So this is give you a notion of distillable, of entanglement that is helpful for some tasks. Make sense? Now, negativity is just defined as the sum of, or minus sum, rather, minus the sum, or the sum of absolute values, whatever you call it, of all negative eigenvalues of rho AB partial transpose. Okay, so it could be partial transpose with respect to A or partial transpose with respect to B. The number is going to be the same. Okay? Perhaps a little exercise proves that the number will be the same regardless of the dimension of the systems. Okay, so that makes sense because...
Just the number be the same or also the eigenvalues?
Not necessarily the eigenvalues. Imagine that you have a 3x2 system. One of them may have 3 eigenvalues, the other one may have 2. Maybe the negative distribution is different. The eigenvalues will not be the same.
Okay, so...
sorry, the partial transpose. Yeah, no, you're right. The eigenvalues will be the same, actually. My bad. in my mind today, I am sometimes saying partial transpose when I... sorry, the opposite. I'm thinking partial trace instead of partial transpose. So forgive me. This is true, for example, for the entanglement entropy. I should have asked that question for the entanglement entropy, not for the negativity. Because the entanglement entropy, you can compute it tracing one or tracing the other, and the eigenvalues are not the same, but the entanglement entropy is, and you can prove it really easily. This one, you are completely right. The eigenvalues are the same. The negative eigenvalues are the same. Okay, so so you see, this is directly based on Peres' criterion. It basically says, okay, yeah, sure, I can move in a family of entangled states to separable states, and I know that at some point when I cross, I'm going to have at some point perhaps that the state becomes non-separable like and doesn't satisfy this condition. So it allows me, if I'm very close to satisfying it, I'm very close to the separable states. Think of qubits, for example, where this is if and only if. If I get a little bit more entangled, I'm going to start getting negative eigenvalues. And for the maximally entangled states, I'm going to have the most negative eigenvalues in the partial transpose that I can. So this measure of entanglement is directly inspired by Peres' criterion. Makes sense, everybody? And it's something that is very natural, right? Because, It's maximal for maximally entangled states, cannot increase under LOCC, although things are true. The only problem that it has is that sometimes it's zero for non-separable states. Those are the states that we called states with bound entanglement, remember? So let's just add it to the table. There are versions, by the way, of negativity that are nicer than negativity, slightly nicer, we will discuss that. But they basically have the same properties. So is it limited to small dimensions? The nice thing is that, well, no, definitely not. It's not limited to small dimensions. This operation that I define works always. So no. Is it easy to compute? Okay, what do you think?
Probably easy.
It's very easy. It's easier than the entanglement entropy. And if that was easy, this one's easy. I have an exclamation point there because it's very easy to compute. It's nicer than, you see, the entanglement entropy involves a partial trace as well. This one involves a partial transpose. Partial transpose is easier than partial trace. That's why I write the exclamation point. Make sense? Still, for somebody in complexity theory, they would say, why do you do this the same? Like, it's polynomial scale. Okay? In the end, you have to diagonalize something. Does it work for non-pure states? Ah, this is really nice. It actually does. There's a powerful characteristic of it. This thing does not require you to talk about pure states at all. It works for any state. Make sense? The function that I defined. Is it an entanglement measure? Sadly, no. But with an asterisk. Because, and the asterisk is two things. Yes, for 2x2 and 3x2. You're not going to see this, but and also another asterisk. It measures distillable entanglement. Make sense? So yeah, it's certainly not an entanglement measure, but it has the advantage that if all that you're interested is entanglement that you can distill into maximally entangled pairs, or maximally entangled pairs of qubits, typically when I say that, then the negativity is telling you if you're going to be able to do it. It's a good test to see if you can distill entanglement from it. Make sense? Now, does it have a nice physical interpretation? This is an opinion thing. What do you think? I would say not necessarily, no, not really. I mean, it depends, because you can say, well, yes, because of distillable entanglement in that. It's a matter of opinion. Not as nice. I'm going to write a maybe here.
Did this entanglement come after people seeing that the eigenvalues are negative, or they thought, okay, there's some physical...
Oh, Peres criterion comes first. Okay. In time. You mean in time, chronologically?
Both chronologically and when you want to think about it. How do you think... Because you're saying there's a physical interpretation, so it means that distillable entanglement has to have another sort of a bigger meaning.
Distillable entanglement is defined as this, not negative eigenvalues. My definition of a distillable entanglement is literally the definition of a worker. I am a worker and I want to create entangled pairs out of a particular state that I gave you. I give you an entangled state of many dimensions and I want to create entangled qubits out of it through LOCC. That's what comes first. And in fact, this was thought to be, in a way, this is a measure of entanglement as well, or thought to be a measure of entanglement. Originally, when people proposed this definition, they thought, oh, that's probably a measure of entanglement.
Yeah, no, but is there a meaning behind the part that the eigenvalues are negative? Because from this, you do your calculation and say, oh.
Not that I know of, not behind the distillable entanglement bit.
Okay.
I don't know everything, though, so it might be, but that's the... The one that I always think of is the fact that you can relate it to distillable entanglement that is a physical thing. You have two people with access to half or parts of a system, and they can talk on the phone to coordinate what they do, how many qubits can they entangle, maximum entangled qubits can they extract. That's for me the meaning. Yeah?
For pure states, I guess negativity also depends on
the whole. Yeah. No, not really. You can have pure states with bound entanglement. Yeah, of more dimensions than 2 by 2 and 3 plus 2. You can. The weakness of negativity is its strength. Because it's not a measure of entanglement, you have bound entanglement, but it tells you if you have distillable entanglement. Because of that, it can distinguish between distillable and bound entanglement. If you know your state is entangled and has zero negativity, you know that you have bound entanglement. Make sense? There's a nicer version. If we call negativity with the calligraphic N letter, there's also another version that I'm not going to talk much about. Logarithmic negativity. All right, which I defined as, what to call it, N sub L, perhaps. And that's going to be the log 2 of 2N plus 1. And what's better about this? Well, as you can tell, it's going to be same behavior, so I'm not going to even talk about it much. But the nice thing about it is that it's additive under tensor product, which is actually pretty nice. Adding a log in there, log 2 typically, makes it now additive under tensor product, and that's cool.
Why plus 1, you say?
Because otherwise, it's going to be ill-defined when this is 0. I want it to be 0 when this is, when the negativity is 0. Make sense?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I prefer my entanglement measures to never be negative. Make sense? I didn't really necessarily tell you, but as long as it doesn't go to infinity, you can always shift it. Sadly, without the plus one, you have a problem. Goes to minus infinity. All right, any questions? Again, not going to write, this has the same properties as that. Perhaps it's nicer in the sense that it's now additive under tensor product, which is something that you may want. It's nice to say, oh, I have 3 units of entanglement here, 3 units here, so the total is 6. That's nice for the entanglement measure. Make sense? Yeah, question?
Little off question. Is it related to Wigner negativity?
No, not at all. Okay, so maybe that's why people add the entanglement negativity. Okay, the answer, short answer, not at all. Long answer, in a way, so let me explain. So Wigner negativity, departing a little bit from the quantum info, this is, if you want, quantum mechanics in general. Wigner negativity is the fact that, well, when I try to describe my system or the state of my system as a probability distribution over phase space, suddenly I realize that some states I can, we call those Gaussian states, by the way, and some states I can't. Well, if I were able to represent my states, probability distributions over phase space, there's nothing quantum about them. Agreed? Nothing at all. It's what we call statistical mechanics, and it's classical. It may be a weird classical theory, but classical nevertheless. I don't need to go through the problem of defining a quantization map, which is tricky. It's very tricky to define a quantization map. In fact, we know it's a new defined problem, in which I map the Poisson brackets to commutators and so on, right? And I want it to be irreducible as well, and that's what is incompatible between the two, the representation that you get in terms of adjoint operators, all that stuff. Now, if you prove that you cannot represent your states as a probability distribution or phase space, there's something truly different between classical mechanics and what you're doing. And that's what makes quantum quantum. Wigner negativity means that in the way of representing, we know that it's only one function, right? A Wigner function is a way of representing quantum states as distributions over phase space. They cannot be probability distributions. In fact, you can prove not just Wigner, you can prove that there's no way to represent some quantum states as probability distributions over phase space. Anything you try is going to fail one way or another. In particular, the Wigner function will be negative at some point, non-positive at some point.
That's like the only difference would be that probability distribution gets negative at some point. And I was thinking that maybe having negative eigenvalues is the same as having the probability.
But it's not, because I can give you an example of a state that is classical, quote unquote, and has entanglement. And that's actually very important in information theory. Gaussian states. I can give you something called the two-mode squeeze state, or the thermal field dual, as they call it in ADS-CFT. Two-mode squeeze state is a Gaussian state. Means I can fully describe that as a probability distribution over phase space. It's a Gaussian that I compress. It's a squeezing of a Gaussian in the direction of the two subsystems. That is a state that is classical, in the sense that you can describe with a probability distribution over phase space, and yet it has entanglement. Not a little. It's the maximal amount of entanglement that you can have at constant energy, because the partial states are thermal. So the partial states have the maximum possible entropy they can have as constant energy. So then we realize something else that is not something that I discuss in a quantum info course typically. It's more a foundations kind of thing, that entanglement per se is not genuinely quantum. What is genuinely quantum is your ability to use that entanglement to violate Bell inequalities. And for that, you need to break Gaussianity at some point. There are papers about that. You need to, in order to violate Bell inequalities, in fact, you know, the first test in 84, when Alana Specht did the experiment of the first Bell experiment, Bell violations, right, that he observed, and his team, he was using Gaussian states. He was using one of those, Tumulus-Quist states, if you want. But the measurement process was not Gaussian. The measurement process introduced non-Gaussianities, therefore cannot be described as a classical theory at all. So we can discuss it as more philosophy or foundations, if you want. But entanglement per se, no, there are classical theories. Gaussian quantum mechanics is a classical theory, defined as I don't need a quantization map to build it, and yet has entanglement. But that having entanglement alone is not enough to be non-classical. However, violating Bell inequalities with entanglement is very non-classical. Make sense? So in that sense, they're related, but not. So sorry for the detour, but it's a really good question for a PSI course, I think. So I appreciate it. And it's a question that is very easy to ask oneself, so if you know about the two concepts. So very, very good question. Any questions about any of that? Again, that's what I think, one thing that I like about the PSI course. On the other hand, goes against covering all the material I want to cover, but I think the compromise is good. All right, so where was I? Yeah, we move to another entanglement measure. And the entanglement measure that I'm gonna talk about now is concurrence. I wish this worked, but it doesn't. The presets used to work, and it was really nice. You haven't seen them, but when you actually use the presets, all the boards move simultaneously in our common reference frame. And that means that it's very flashy. And they are rearranged themselves, but they don't work anymore. So you don't get to see them, sorry. All right. Concurrence. I'm going to give you two definitions, quote unquote, for concurrence. Because depending who you ask, they're going to tell you one definition or another. One of them is general. The other one is particular. And some people call concurrence to the particularized one. Already, but I'll give you the full general. Just keep that in mind. All right. Concurrence of some density operator AB. All right. It's going to be the infimum over the set of PJs, the convex combinations, and psi ABJ of the sum over J of the following function. Calligraphic C, looks like an E, but I can only do so much with my handwriting. Psi AB I, psi AB I. And then this function calligraphic C of psi AB I, psi AB I, is the square root, a positive square root of twice 1 minus the trace of rho square A, where rho square A, of course, remember, or rho A, right, is the partial trace with respect to B of rho AB. Okay, and rho, okay, yeah, I didn't really tell you what this state was. Rho AB. It's going to be written like that. That's the constraint on the optimization. J, PJ, psi AB rho, J, psi AB J. All right, so pretty in both, yeah.
Is the sum from I to J?
Oh, no. This is not an I. There's never an I, or it's the same index everywhere. This is just me messing it up. Okay, makes sense, everybody? So now, I gave you a flashy definition, which is a convex optimization kind of definition, if you can tell. So what is this? So look at the logic. The logic is, all right, I know that I can write a bipartite density matrix in this form. Agreed? Right. And these are bipartite states. That's why I can do it like that. And then you say, okay, good. The decomposition is definitely not, so one way of saying, okay, I write it like that, and then I count the entanglement entropy, because these are pure states. So the logic, let me just tell you the logic that somebody may have had to build it, okay? At least my logic when I look at it. I say, right, I can write rho AB as a convex combination of bipartite states. But those bipartite states that are pure, these are projectors, so they correspond to pure states. So for those, the entanglement entropy is really cool. Works really well as an entanglement measure. So maybe I can, in a way, sum the entanglement entropy of every single one of them and weight it with this probability, right? So maybe that gives me an idea of how entangled this is, right? That's the logic, the naive, if you want, logic behind it, or the first idea. Naive is not bad. Naive is good. You know, in English, it's necessarily not good. In fact, that's negative connotations. But in case of building something, you typically, you know that in mathematical physics, we typically start naive, and then we see what problems we have, and then we try to improve on that, no? So that would be the naive logic, if you want. Now, this is not the entanglement entropy, but almost. Because this is, if you want, remember, this is the purity, right, of rho A, and 1 minus the purity behaves like an entropy. In fact, it's kind of a Renyi entropy, but behaves like an entropy in the sense that entanglement entropy is maximal for maximal entangled states and so on, and works exactly the same way as an entropy, as a von Neumann entropy would. So it's a simplified version of the entanglement entropy. I might as well, I could have written here entanglement entropy, and the same logic would have applied. Okay, cool. What is the issue with this definition, though? Well, the issue, there are several issues. Issue number one, this decomposition is not unique, right? So there are some decompositions that have more or less entanglement. Agreed? So I'm going to have an issue with it. So if I can find a decomposition that has a lot of entanglement, but also another decomposition that is separable, what does it tell me? Because that could happen. I'm telling you already, that could happen. You can have such a decomposition in terms of maximally entangled states, and at the same time, one decomposition that has no entanglement. OK, so then what? well, that's why there's the infimum here. You say, well, if you can find a separable decomposition, what you're seeing is an illusion, and this thing can increase on the length of CC. So do that, and if you cannot find one that is separable, that's the logic, then it's probably entangled. See what I mean? If there's no way to write this in terms of combinations of convex combination of separable states, then the state is probably entangled. And then, of course, you need to write about, how many, I forget, about 30 pages of proofs to actually check that you satisfy the conditions that you want from entanglement measures. And there you go, concurrence. Make sense, everybody? Now, we go back to your logic before. This is a problem of convex optimization in a space of what dimension? Keep in mind that I'm optimizing over these combinations of PJs and bipartite vectors. This huge. It's really huge. It's a bad problem. When you have, as you say, you have 6 qubits, you're done with this. So forget about higher dimensions to be able to compute with that. So a problem of convex optimization over a state of space is typically NP-hard, which is not surprising, right? Because this is an entanglement measure. So, well, anyway, we'll see. So we grasp that this thing is an optimization problem that is not easy, no? There's another version of concurrence for a system of 2 qubits. C, rho AB, I define, it's going to be weird, the definition, just be prepared. Don't try to interpret it too much. It's a definition that you can prove from the general definition when you particularize it to 2 qubits. So I define that as the max of the set 0, lambda 1, minus lambda 2, minus lambda 3, minus lambda 4, where this is an ordered version of the eigenvalues of the operator And what is R, you may ask? Well, R hat is this, is the square root of rho AB, rho tilde, square root of rho AB. And what's rho tilde, you may ask? Well, rho tilde is defined as sigma y, tensor sigma y, for A and for B, that means, of rho AB conjugate. All right, and then sigma y, tensor sigma y. And where rho conjugate AB, actually I shouldn't write the hat, because this is just matrices if you want. Rho AB is the complex conjugate of the representation of rho AB in what we call the computational basis. Which means in the basis made out of the eigenvectors of sigma z. Okay. So pretty intricate definition. Let me just tell you. So what you have to do is, okay, you have your rho AB, then write it in the computational basis, just pick a direction in the Bloch sphere, call it the computational basis. The entries of that matrix in the computational basis, take the conjugate, multiply by the Kronecker product of the sigma y times sigma y, sigma y, sigma y. Did write an A here, that means a B, obviously, right? And then multiply by the square root of rho AB, square root of rho AB, and you have the R, diagonalize that matrix, order the eigenvalues, and this is the quantity that you're left with, this is that. It looks intricate, because it is, but as opposed to this, this is very easy. It's matrix multiplication and diagonalization. Make sense? Computer would not complain too much. A student might, because intricate, but a computer would not complain. Make sense? Does that make sense? I'm not going to put concurrence there just yet, because I want to introduce another entanglement measure before that one. By the way, negativity and concurrence are related. Let me just give it to you. Here. We know that concurrence is larger or equal than twice the negativity, which is larger or equal than root of 1 minus c squared plus c squared minus 1 minus c. And fun fact, for qubits, a system of 2 qubits, a 2x2 system whose matrix is like this, we call it x states for a reason in the computational basis. Then we know that C is exactly equal to twice the negativity. It's curiosities, if you want. They're not independent. And in fact, again, for X states, you understand what I mean, right? The entries are zero except for that X here. Then it actually coincides. You see people, that's the thing. When you propose these things, there are many people trying to look for ways to relate things, right? And one of them is that, and that's particularly nice. At least in the field of relativistic quantum information, there's a protocol called entanglement harvesting where you have, in the end, matrices like that, a leading order in perturbation theory. So which one you use in that case is your choice. Anyways, so before going to putting this on the table, I'm going to introduce another entanglement measure. We put them together because they're not, there's a relationship between them. Yeah, that's not great. Okay, now. And the back one, it should be one that's coming down slowly. You see, that's automatic and simultaneous, so it's kind of nice when it works. Entanglement of formation. Typically abbreviated as EOF. So let me give you first the hand-wavy definition of it, and then the formal definition of it. So it's amount of Bell pairs required to build row AB through LOCC. So as you can tell, it's the converse of the distillable entanglement. This is, okay, you have an entangled state rho AB. Can I build that state with LOCC? No, because LOCC cannot create the entanglement. Ah, but if I give you LOCC and a number of Bell states, can you? Well, maybe, yeah. Yeah, I can. If you give me enough of those guys. Obviously, if it's a dimension 5 maximally entangled state, you're going to require at least 5 of those, right? But yeah, well, no, 5, actually. It's more than, it's less, like a little bit less than that. But whatever. So you're going to require more, right? The more entanglement you have in your state. So this could be proposed as an entanglement measure. And in fact, let me define it like this. Let me give you the formal definition. Entanglement of formation of row AB is the infimum of, over the same kind of infimum. Huh? So PI psi I PI entanglement of formation of at the pure state AB, where the entanglement of formation of a pure state is, surprise, surprise, the entanglement entropy. Or in other words, the entanglement entropy of the state psi I. Makes sense, everybody? So this definition, it's very similar to the concurrence, only that I'm actually using the entanglement entropy. See what I mean? This is what I told you. That's why I want them together. They're very related. Make sense, everybody?
This is only for like distillable entanglement, but with
concurrence. No. This is not for distillable entanglement. This is not distillable entanglement. We will discuss.
I can talk about bound entanglement because it's only talking about like.
So there's no such thing as bound entanglement in dimension 2. So we will discuss that, I promise. Can you just park it for a second? Because we will discuss it. Because for many years, people thought that entanglement of formation was the same as distillable entanglement. And only relatively recently was proven not to be the case. And the reason is bound entanglement, precisely.
But concurrence has bound entanglement naturally inside. Like, it's not, is it true? Like,
yeah, and these two. Both of them will be non-zero for bound entangled states. Okay, so the logic here is that I think somebody suggested it. You know, this year, last year for sure. Oh, can I have a state like that? The state is the same as with the concurrence, right? The state is some convex combination. Can I just say that I have the convex combination of the entanglement entropy of each of them? Well, the answer is, well, yeah, but that decomposition is not unique. And again, you can find one that's entangled, one that is not, which one you pick. So therefore, the infimum in here. You have at least one that's separable, that's not entangled. Make sense? Entanglement of formation and concurrence are, unsurprisingly perhaps, related by a very easy relationship. Entanglement of formation of rho AB is this H function of 1 plus root 1 minus the concurrence of row AB divided by 2, where h of x is a binary Shannon entropy. This function of h of x appears ubiquitously in quantum info related stuff. So get used to this one, minus x log 2 x minus 1 minus x, not for this course, because again, this course is a quick introduction, but important to remember that expression. We can call it the Shannon function or something like that. You can tell that looks a lot like the Shannon entropy, right? Of some distribution that is binary and has probability x of one entry and 1 minus x of the other. Make sense? This is not that surprising because they parallel each other, right? They really do. One uses the entanglement entropy, the other one uses the purity, or rather the non-purity, the mixedness. 1 minus rho squared. All right, so this is nice. It has two nice properties. It's what we call faithful. The word faithful simply means it is an entanglement measure. You know why we use a word for that? Because we call all of those entanglement measures, even if they're not, even if they fail sometimes, we call them entanglement measures. And we distinguish an entanglement measure by a faithful one. Faithful meaning satisfies everything here. You know, no, everything up there. The one thing that is sacred up there is must not increase under L of CC. That is the most sacred part, because that's the characteristic of entanglement that's most important. If you don't satisfy that, then you don't call yourself an entanglement measure. If you do, well, maybe you want to call yourself an entanglement measure, but if you satisfy all of them, you call yourself a faithful entanglement measure. So for example, negativity is faithful for 2 qubits. Negativity is faithful for a Q-trit and a qubit. Negativity is not faithful for the rest. Make sense?
Concurrence is not faithful?
Concurrence is faithful. Because, well, I'm about to say E of F is faithful and this is concurrent, so if one is faithful, the other one has to be, right? Make sense? And for this is a nice property that none of the entanglement measures that I've given you has for pure states. Well, for pure states, it reduces to the entanglement entropy, right? And that's nice because this is a generalization of the entanglement entropy. You know what a generalization of a function is? It's a function that is the same that you know whenever it's well defined and something else that makes sense when it's not. You can generalize in a very stupid way, which is, for example, I always give an example that is called the Eduardo sum. The Eduardo sum is a sum that is the regular sum whenever a sum is convergent, and then it's 42 when not. It's a generalization of the sum, all right, but it's not a really good one, right? Make sense? No, okay. But this one makes sense. All righty.
It should always be 42.
What's that?
The answer should always be 42.
I fully agree. That's why I do it like that. All right, so now we can put together concurrence and entanglement of formation here and discuss them a bit. You see, we're not going to have enough time to finish all the entanglement measures today, but that is fine. Concurrence. It is limited to small dimensions. Well, let's begin with this one. Is it easy to compute concurrence?
No! Exclamation mark.
Very nice. No, in general. But yes, for 2x2. Right? Because for 2x2, we know it's easy. But in general, certainly no exclamation mark. Very good. Is it limited to small dimension?
No.
No, but just for 2x2. No, but yes, when easy. Okay. Does it work for non-pure states? Yeah, not a problem. Is it an entanglement measure? Actually, it is. Does it have a nice physical interpretation? Well, depending how you, on its own, I would say, yeah. On its own. But of course, yes, through entanglement of formation. So maybe the answer, this is an opinion thing, so I can write whatever I want here, right? But I can discuss and justify why I picked it. Let's do entanglement of formation. Is it limited to small dimension?
No, never.
Okay, entanglement of formation. Is it easy to compute?
No.
Exclamation point.
Okay, what's the difference between concurrence and entanglement of formation in 2x2? Because it's exactly the same.
No, it's not the same. They're related by that.
It's just the function.
Yeah, exactly.
But the function is also easy to compute.
Sure. But because of the, okay, right here. No. Yes, for 2x2. How about that? You're right. Does it work for non-pure states?
Yes.
Is it an entanglement measure?
Yes.
Does it have a nice physical interpretation? Very much so. As good as the entanglement entropy, because indeed it's a generalization of the entanglement entropy. Make sense? All right, so let me give you, before we move to the discussion, because the lecture is finished, let me just give you an, if you want, a spoiler of something that we will see in the next lecture-ish, which is mutual information. Now, mutual information, this is a spoiler, so you don't need to copy it for your notes yet. I'm going to repeat it. Mutual information of between two random variables x, y, is defined in two ways. That are equivalent, classically. Well, of course. And just a reminder that the condition probability of A given B is the probability of A intersection B divided by the probability of B. Anyway, so I just wanted to mention that. Mutual information is another measure that maybe wants to be something like entanglement measure. We'll see it's not, but maybe wants to be. Classically, it's got a very neat interpretation, which is, look at this. This is kind of very neat. You look at both. Ignorance in x plus ignorance in y minus the ignorance in the total distribution. Ignorance in y minus the ignorance in y after revealing x, a value of x. So you can tell how this is measuring correlations, right? The mutual information is indeed the amount of, if you use log 2 for the logs, right, is the amount of bits of information about x or about y that I, or bits of ignorance about x that I remove after being revealed one bit of information about y. So in a way, you see that it measures correlations, right? This is very intuitive. These two definitions are the same. You can prove them for classical probability distributions. You can prove them to be the same. So happens that for quantum mechanics, the equivalent to that where you replace the Shannon entropies of the distributions by the von Neumann entropies of the distribution, the two definitions are difficult to make compatible. In fact, they're not the same because, importantly, this bit is like, okay, if you reveal a bit of information about x, what does that mean? That means making a measurement. That's a big difference. So classically, revealing information doesn't require something like making a measurement, and we will see that making measurements is complicated. In fact, as I told you, I'm going to do on Wednesday talk about measurements from the quantum information point of view with a tiny snippet of the measurement problem in QFT as well, because this is a PSI course, and that matters a lot. It's much worse, let me tell you, in QFT, the measurement problem than it is. So we're going to see POVMs in the next lecture that you need for the tutorial. We're going to see the measurement problem. And we will revisit this, because then we can talk about mutual information. And as you tell, there are two things there that are not filled. So we will talk about mutual information. We could talk about quantum discord, which is precisely the difference between these two definitions in the quantum case and what it means, and the notions of quantum correlations that are not classical. Now, we can discuss a little bit now about this, and a little bit about which measure is your favorite. I hope that you have seen that you have to make a compromise. Things are either easy or not entanglement measures. Make sense? Does that make sense? That I only given you 1, 2, 3, 4 entanglement measures. That applies to all entanglement measures known by humankind at the moment. Which makes sense, right? Because the problem is NP-hard. If you can prove that there's an easy entanglement measure, easy to compute, that is faithful, then you've proven P versus NP. Well, or at least you have an example of P versus NP. So obviously, that is not going to happen anytime soon. Make sense, everybody? If I have something that is easy, well, not quite. No, no. NP-hard equals NP complete, or NP, the full category. It's a slightly weaker version, because this is easy to check. But if you also say that it's easy to compute, then you prove P versus NP. So you see, that's to be expected, that you have to make compromises. Does that make sense? Now here, my favorite, I'm going to tell you, the one that I use a lot, is negativity and logarithmic negativity. Because for me, additivity and the tensor product is really cool. And to be honest, in all cases where concurrence and entanglement information is computable, it's as good as them. And one more. Also, it distinguishes, you can actually apply it for entanglement between harmonic oscillators in continuous variables, or between a quantum field and something else. You can actually apply it. And it works. It'll tell you the distillable entanglement that it has, right? So that's my favorite. Some people have concurrence as their favorite. It's up to you. I mean, this is a matter of preference. And I'm happy to stay around as usual until 10 past, quarter past to discuss things. You can, I think, erase this, no problem. Yeah.
I just had a question about the infimum. Like, what is that? It's a superset of...
Okay, what, sorry?
It's a superset of all the possible states.
Yeah, yeah. It's the set made out of all the possible states and all the possible convex combinations of them. So you not only have to optimize over sets of states, you have to optimize, given a set of states, all the possible combinations of them, convex.
So the
AB.
The density matrix row AB is unique. The density matrix row A is not unique.
So that, is that state? There are infinitely many ways of writing that. Well, infinitely, depends on your dimension. So there are more than, it's not unique, optimized over all possible ways of writing it like that. That's what it means.
Because in that, you're choosing a basis when you write it as the sum.
No, no, I'm not choosing a basis. These are sets of states, if you want. And keep in mind, those are bipartite states. Well, in a way, you can think of it as choosing a basis if you want. But they don't have, the states are a basis, but they don't have to be, they form a basis, because written like that, have to be orthogonal. So I agree. But all the possible decompositions like that you can think of.